From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Today was supposed to be the day when the fate of young immigrants known as Dreamers would be decided. But court rulings and political fighting over this in Washington has made the timeline more vague. For months now, Congress and the White House have gone back and forth over whether to end this group's special but temporary immigration status. Various compromises have been floated to preserve the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program. That's the Obama-era initiative that allowed young adults brought here illegally as kids to stay. But none of these proposed deals has stuck, and today, roughly 700,000 of these immigrants around the country live in a kind of legal limbo, including an estimated 15,000 here in New England. Today in The Exchange, how the DACA debate plays out close to home. Let's hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We'll bring in several voices into our conversation this hour. With me in studio, Ron Abramson, an immigration attorney based in Manchester. Ron, welcome. Good to see you.
Good morning, Laura. Always good to be here.
And in a few moments, we'll be joined by Shannon Dooling. She's a reporter for the New England News Collaborative, where she reports on education. Later in the hour, we'll have a researcher on who's got some criticism of the DACA program. All that, of course, plus your comments at exchange@nhpr.org. So, Ron, before we get into all the rulings and politics and status, just give us a DACA basics, if you could, please, Ron. When did President Obama set this up, and why?
DACA came out of chronic frustration with passing the DREAM Act, which goes back over a decade, and it stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and it set off a series of criteria requirements that a person would have to meet. And it's basically an administrative status. It's not a substantive immigration status. It doesn't lead to anything. And as the name implies, it is basically a promise by the government to defer action on people who could otherwise be put into removal or what's otherwise called deportation proceedings. So there were requirements in terms of the date by which a person had to be in the United States, the age, they had to be under 16 when they came. They had to either be in school, have obtained a high school education, a GED, be in the military. They cannot have a criminal record, any felony, significant misdemeanor, or three or more other misdemeanors would disqualify them. And then they had to show that they had continuous physical presence in the U.S. since 2007.
And these, again, were children brought by their parents when they were little.
Correct. The overwhelming majority came with their parents. Some may have actually come in on their own or may have come in with family members, but correct. The idea is that it involves people who came into the United States at an age where they didn't really have any say in the matter.
And can we assume, Ron, that since their parents brought them here illegally, the parents are also illegal?
By and large, that's probably true. They didn't all necessarily arrive illegally. Some of them may have come legally and stayed past their allotted visa time. Their parents may have been in a different status which expired or they couldn't renew. And many of them actually have or would have had some sort of petition or application pending, but based on the arcane and esoteric workings of the family-based visa preferences, may have just had what seemed like interminable waits before their dates became current.
And you mentioned Dreamers right at the outset there, Ron. So what's the relationship between DACA recipients and Dreamers? Are they the same people?
The overlap is substantial. Depending on how you define it, it could be more or less expansive. But the DREAM Act would be the legislative solution. In other words, that would be the congressional law that actually makes all these people, quote, legal, whereas DACA, deferred action, is executive discretion applied to a particularly defined class.
I see. So the DREAM Act would be an act of Congress that would settle this matter once and for all. DACA is sort of a temporary program to protect these folks here illegally while their status is debated.
Exactly. And there were two rounds of significant hope for people who wanted to see comprehensive immigration reform, both of which eventually flailed out. There was action in 2006, there was action in 2008, and it was after these particular proposals didn't even ever come up for a formal vote in Congress, that President Obama established DACA.
I see. And I remember probably talking to you about those, Ron. Now, there was some bipartisan compromise in the Senate. I think former Senator Ayotte was involved in some of those.
That's correct.
Bipartisan compromises, but then trouble cropped up in the House, and here we are today.
Here we are.
Well, Shannon Dooling is with us now. Again, she's a reporter for WBUR and the New England News Collaborative, where she's been doing a lot of reporting on immigration in New England. And Shannon, welcome to The Exchange. Great to have you.
Thank you, Laura. It's great to be here.
Well, and you've reported that about 15,000 of these young immigrants, illegal immigrants, are spread around New England. Where do they live, Shannon?
That's right. And I should say that those numbers are based on estimates from U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, which is the agency that processes DACA applications. And the overwhelming majority live or have listed addresses, I should say, on their applications. They've listed addresses in Massachusetts and Connecticut. So nearly 8,000 recipients listed Massachusetts as their place of residence and 5,000 recipients in Connecticut. Rhode Island was up there with about 1,000 recipients. And in New Hampshire, it was the numbers just under 400. And Vermont and Maine are both have recipients under 100, respectively. And, you know, it's, again, important to point out that these are just people who actually, the numbers reflect folks who actually received the DACA status. So that doesn't necessarily count all of the people who, you know, originally applied or might be eligible and have not applied.
Well, that's interesting. And we should clarify that point. So this is not a count of all illegal immigrants in New England or even young illegal immigrants, young adult illegal immigrants in New England. It is basically just those who have said, Shannon, correct me if I'm wrong, okay, I would like that temporary protection under DACA.
That's right. And those are only the numbers of people who received that temporary protection under DACA. And so, you know, the numbers of people who applied and for whatever reason, maybe they weren't eligible to some of the eligibility requirements that Ron was just touching upon, you know, didn't receive DACA. But those are the numbers of people who have received it. And you know, it's important to note as well that coming forward and, you know, raising your hand and sharing your address and your family's information with the government for someone who was brought up in a family, you know, that maybe was accustomed to quote unquote living in the shadows. And that took some courage and, you know, didn't come without some really serious decision making in all of those households. So that's something to consider as well.
Well, and I really wanted to ask both of you about that. So I'm glad you raised it, Shannon. And Ron, to you, this idea of DACA applications that you and Shannon are talking about, you know, saying, here's my address in Massachusetts, here's where I live in New Hampshire. That kind of goes against the cardinal rule of families living here illegally, doesn't it? Where you don't give information to anybody.
There's no question that anybody who decides to avail themselves of a process like this one that was never decreed to be permanent, is not a permanent solution, is it's an act of faith, it's an act of trust.
It's a risk.
And it's a risk. And we see people, especially now, there was a sense initially that the program would last long enough that there would be a next step, which would be a DREAM Act or some sort of comprehensive reform. And that's what the genesis of this was to create a bridge to reasoned, informed, humane reform. And to the extent that everything is currently so volatile, I was asked to give a talk on DACA a couple weeks ago, and I said, okay, but I will write it 15 minutes before it starts, because we really didn't know what was happening based
right,
on
yeah.
the court decisions, based on the congressional back and forth. And there were four proposals put forth, all of which included some semblance of a DREAM fix, and none of which got the 60 votes in the Senate needed to move on.
Talk about what you've heard, Shannon, please, from the families you've interviewed. This kind of strategic decision whether to register for DACA or not.
Yeah, it is a strategic decision, and I think it's one that each individual and each family has, had to consider their own personal circumstances in deciding whether or not to apply for that. Interestingly, now, as the state of DACA is sort of in this limbo with court decisions that I'm sure we'll talk about, but basically the decision now is do I try to renew my application? And so, do I, knowing that there's a new administration, knowing that there's new enforcement priorities in place in terms of immigration law, do I take that leap of faith again? And I think for some people, I've met a lot of young college students, for instance, who maybe this is their first year, at attending a college or a university, and they want to do whatever they can to remain eligible for, let's say financial aid or scholarships, and having a DACA status enables them to be able to do that. But they have to weigh those risks of, okay, well, am I putting my family in danger so that I can go to college? And there are some folks who are maybe pursuing their medical degrees and have 1 or 2 years left on that path, and what does that look like if their status, if they're not going to be able to, secure a job and not have work authorization, if their DACA status at some point is ultimately finally dismantled. They're homeowners. A lot of people have mortgages. They have started families. They have young children. Chances are many of their children are U.S. citizens. So that goes to this point of sort of what we talk about when we think of a mixed status household, where everyone in the home could have a different opportunities available to them, and that just complicates these decisions even more and adds to that sense of anxiety and the unknown.
How do you get a mortgage, Shannon, if you're here illegally?
Well, I mean, people with DACA, they have a temporary status. And so these are folks who have employment authorization. They have a Social Security number. They pay taxes. They have income. And that's, I'm presuming, I don't own a home. I don't have a mortgage, but I'm presuming that's enough for a lot of places to be able to get a loan. And they have they can get licenses. They can get, in some states, I should say, they can get identification, like I said, Social Security cards. And so, they're not here as citizens, but they have a status. They have a temporary status when they're here with DACA. And that's an important differentiation to make.
Wow. Yeah. Talk about that as well, Ron. That's really interesting. So you have some rights and inclusion, but not completely.
Correct. The sort of operative phrase is that they are here essentially with the consent or permission of the Attorney General of the executive branch. So this all sort of traces back up through the executive branch. And when you have work authorization, that generally is tied into a temporary status that allows you to remain here and that has what's called employment incident to that status. So they are allowed to work while they're here. And as soon as you have a valid employment authorization card, you can apply for a Social Security number. You generally can open a bank account, and depending on the criteria of a specific bank and your own credit history, income, et cetera, you can apply for a mortgage. And yes, these are, by and large, people who already have substantial roots and are just seeking to move through society and pursue their version of the American dream like virtually anyone else.
Does applying for DACA protection, Ron, take years out of the process by which you might just, quote unquote, stand in line, go through the regular long citizenship process? Do you see what I'm trying to get at there? If it takes 10 years and you're under DACA for 8, did you basically waste those years when you could have been in the regular process?
Well, not to plug immigration lawyers too boldly, but that is where it is important to get a legal opinion to assess whether other options are available. And maybe it was a petitioning family member. Maybe it was enrolling in school in a student visa. Maybe it's taking a romantic relationship and deciding to take the next step and get married to a U.S. citizen. So all of those options should be explored and may or may not be on the table. But generally, if you are in DACA status, it's because there was no other option available to allow you to remain lawfully however temporarily, in this country.
DACA in New England is our topic today in the Exchange, and let's hear from you. You can send us an email with your questions, comments, concerns about how this whole debate playing out in Washington is affecting us here in our region. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. Or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. So Shannon and Ron, got a couple comments by email from Matt. And Matt, I'll share a couple of these. Thank you very much. Matt says, I would provide DACA kids a path to legal status after the border is properly secured. Border control is a sovereign right of any country. As important is the need, Matt says, for new citizens to assimilate, not set up a separate culture. That is the end of any country, Matt says. Yes, we are a country of immigrants, but controlling our borders is not the end of America. Unlimited and uncontrolled illegal immigration is. So, Matt, thank you so much. And a couple questions that come out from his comments. And Shannon, to you first, tie in the debate over border security and how that has been tied up with the issue of DACA. And then, Ron, I have a different question for you. But go ahead, Shannon.
Sure. It's been tied up pretty intimately in Congress and out of the White House, especially. You know, we've heard President Trump even sort of prefacing and immediately following the Attorney General's announcement of DACA being phased out back in September. We heard the president talk about his sort of great heart, his big heart for these young people, these DACA recipients, and the fact that, you know, he really just put the onus on Congress to legislate a solution for this. And but in doing so, you know, we've also seen him, the president, really you know, use these DACA recipients, these so-called dreamers, you know, as political pawns in a real way, in terms of, you know, sort of holding them hostage, if you will, for funding for his border wall along the southern border. And just to your commenter's point about assimilation and you know, securing the borders before welcoming in folks like DACA recipients. It is worth noting that many of these young people have spent the majority of their lives at this point in the United States. You know, English is for many of them their first language. It's something that they speak fluently in their households. I mean, this is home for many of them. And some of the young people that I've met over the course of my reporting, you know, don't have any recollection of their home countries. Of the countries they were born in. It's just not a place that they are at all familiar with. But to your question, Laura, yes, the border wall and funding for the border wall has been intimately tied with progress or lack thereof in the negotiations over DACA status.
All right. Well, Matt, thank you for the emails. And we'll take more of your comments and questions in just a moment. Again, you can email us like Matt did, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And coming up, we talk with an immigration researcher who's got some questions about DACA. All that is in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
You can help NHPR cut our March fund drive in half. I'm Rick Gamble, host of Morning Edition. You deserve exceptional and independent journalism grounded in facts. That's our focus every day, to seek out the truth and deliver it to you. But keeping NHPR independent requires resources, and we're asking you to pitch in. Help us raise all the money in half the time to get you back to the news you trust and the programs you love. Give now at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, how the DACA debate in Washington is playing out here in New England. If you want to learn more, by the way, go to our website, nhpr.org. There's a lot more information, links, including one to NHPR's Civics 101 episode on this issue. You can join us now with your questions and comments. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Shannon Dooling is with us for the hour. She's a reporter for WBUR and the New England News Collaborative, where she reports on immigration. Ron Abramson is in studio, immigration attorney based in Manchester. And joining us by phone now from D.C., Jessica Vaughn. She's director of policy studies for the Center for Immigration Studies in D.C. And Jessica, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
How do you feel about the DACA program overall, Jessica?
Well, first of all, it was definitely an unconstitutionally implemented program. It was done without the authority or involvement of Congress. It was not something that the president had the authority to do. So, you know, that's the most fundamental problem with it. But the other problem with it is it was not good policy because, I think everyone understands that this particular group of illegal aliens is, you know, in a different situation than most. And it's a problem that was created by past neglect of enforcing immigration laws, and that, you know, I think people agreed that, it should be possible to find a solution to provide them with an amnesty, but that it had to be done in conjunction with other measures to prevent it, you know, prevent illegal immigration from happening so much for the future, but also to mitigate the effects of an amnesty by cutting back on other forms of legal immigration, specifically chain migration and the visa lottery.
So it sounds like, Jessica, you feel like this group of young people is kind of here illegally but caught up in a mess.
Well, that's right. That's right. And I'm not sure that the DACA program necessarily, I mean, obviously it provided them with a work permit and the ability to stay here, but it didn't solve anything really, except for those individuals for the short term. And you know, it's clear that the responsibility for fixing this has to be with Congress. And unfortunately, Congress had this opportunity a few weeks ago and was not able to do it. So it's got to be very frustrating. I think everyone is very frustrated at this point. But it's also important to remember that nobody is in any, you know, immediate danger of being forced to leave the country unless they are someone who shouldn't have gotten DACA to begin with. So I think there is also a lot of panic that's happening that's unfortunate, that is being stoked by some of the advocacy groups. And the courts have now complicated matters by removing a deadline that Congress seems to need anyway to get anything done. But this is going to be festering for a number of months now because the Senate is so polarized and divided. They cannot move forward on this. And I think, frankly, that the Democrats really miss an opportunity to resolve this with a deal that was probably better than any they're going to get in the future.
Well, and you're alluding to my next question, Jessica. I mean, you're right. There's been so much back and forth. All we've seen in the half a year or so when the White House announced that it wanted to end DACA is just a lot of discussion, a lot of fighting, a lot of potential deals. Seems like people are figuring it out. And then it all comes crashing to the floor. What makes this so difficult to resolve?
What makes this so difficult is that there are very different feelings about and views on what should happen, that people are very divided and that people have become entrenched in their positions. And, you know, on the one hand, there are many Republicans who don't believe there should be an amnesty at all for people with DACA. And on the other hand, there are Democrats who refuse to go along with any deal that is not a much more expansive amnesty. So, you know, they just will not move from these positions, and that makes it difficult.
So what do you think should happen, Jessica? Your group has been, you know, critical of looser immigration policies. What do you think is the correct way through this sort of amnesty for everyone on one end and, you know, everyone needs to be deported on the other end?
Well, I think the best solution would be to provide an amnesty to the people who received DACA, and actually give them green cards at a certain point and put them on a path to citizenship, but do that in at the same time enact reductions in other aspects of legal immigration to offset this new number of green cards and the chain migration effects from that, and also implement some better immigration enforcement measures to stem illegal immigration and to help make sure that we're not going to be having this same discussion 10 years from now, and that includes border security, but also some funds for interior enforcement to try to reduce the size of the illegal population that's here. I mean, it's about 12 million people, and so one amnesty is not going to solve that. But we can do a better job of making it less attractive to come here illegally and get employment and live here without authorization. That's something that has to be changed, or we're never going to make progress on this. So there was a deal there. I didn't like all aspects of the president's deal, but I thought it was pretty close to what should happen.
So give protection, give a path to citizenship, give green cards to DACA, but reduce other forms of legal and illegal immigration. That seems to be what you're saying, Jessica.
Exactly right.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Jessica Vaughn, again, Director of Policy Studies for the Center for Immigration Studies in Washington. And you can join us, too. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. So, Ron, what did you hear in that call out with Jessica Vaughn? This seems to be a microcosm of what we've heard in Washington. Okay, give DACA recipients permanent status, path to citizenship, whatever. But let's work on some other ends of immigration that, you know, bother people in the conservative realm.
That ties back into what you or Shannon might have mentioned about essentially having this class of people caught in the crossfire between competing immigration considerations. The first and probably most important thing with which I would take exception that Ms. Vaughn said was that Americans are divided about DACA. Congress may be divided, and there may be some intractable elements there, but recent polls show 70%+ support for the DREAM Act among the population. So really, this becomes an issue of certain people playing to certain political elements in their own base and just refusing to allow what would effectively be more like a national referendum on the issue. But for the overwhelming majority of the people in this country, this seems like an issue that should bring legal, moral, and political clarity to bear.
So you're saying, Ron, don't tie the fate of DACA recipients to this broader mess of immigration policy battles? Is that what you're saying?
That is what I'm saying. I'm saying that this is a unique set of circumstances that does not implicate significant criticism of past policy or reform of future policy, and therefore a standalone DREAM Act is the proper humane way to handle this.
So, but we heard earlier from Matt, our emailer in Vermont, who said, you know, sympathy for the DACA recipients, but they are here illegally. So that does rub some people the wrong way, Ron.
Well, there's been a discussion about using border enforcement as a precursor to any immigration reform, but it's a non-starter because to the extent that all elements of this discussion agree with a secure border, nobody who is serious about this proposes an open border, then essentially you're creating a bar that nobody can overcome, and therefore it's not discussing this or negotiating it in good faith.
Let's take some calls. And again, email as well, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. And Shannon and Ron, let's go to Nick in Concord. Hi, Nick. You're on the air. Welcome to the Exchange. Nick, go ahead. You're on the air. Good morning.
Oh, sorry.
No problem. It's Monday.
So I was just listening to your program, hearing about people's comments about immigration, and mostly I just wanted to say that this is largely as a result of former 20-year-old policy changes. That formerly we had a more circular immigration policy that allowed people to enter and leave the United States to work under work visas. But around the 90s, during the Clinton administration, there was significant changes to that. As a result of that, numerous people simply overstayed their visas, not as a result of let's come in and take all the jobs, but more as a result of, you know, we've already been here for 20 years helping support our families in another country. However you want to argue that, it's a little facetious to make it sound as if people are flooding into this country, when in reality they're not. I mean, we have, as a result of significant changes, we've had numerous improvements along our border security making the assumption that saying that there's this massive flood of people is categorically false.
I see what you're saying, Nick. Yeah, and I have seen those numbers as well. Shannon, I don't know if you can enlighten us that immigration from our southern border has dropped considerably in recent years.
Yeah, I think that is an accurate observation based on the numbers down there. And I think it's an important point that the caller brings up that, not all of the people who are in the country illegally right now without documentation entered illegally. I don't have a grasp on the latest numbers in terms of a breakdown of the 12 million immigrants who are in the country without documentation that Ms. Vaughn pointed out. I don't know what the breakdown is among those in terms of people who crossed the border illegally or overstayed visas, but a good portion of people did enter the country legally with legal means, and as the caller points out, simply did chose to overstay a visa or some other means. But I think one thing to point out is that there has been tangible sort of fear factor, if you will, of folks who maybe would have entered the country under a different administration taking a second look at that decision, given the current political sort of landscape with immigration enforcement in our country right now.
Nick, thank you for the call. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Did you want to jump in, Ron, as well?
I just wanted to add that it's one thing to spend your life looking at numbers and crunching statistics and trying to conduct analysis. It's another to actually be exposed to and interact with the folks who are in these situations day to day. And I can tell you that after almost 25 years practicing law, 20 of them in the immigration realm specifically, the two major motivators for people coming here are economic and family. And in almost every case, they are related. You know, if we want to get serious about some of these enforcement actions, we need to come down harder on employers. But I can tell you, having represented hundreds of employers over the years, if they could hire people from here to do the jobs, they would. They don't appreciate the bureaucracy, the extra filing fees, the extra legal fees, and the unpredictability and delays in getting people to do their jobs. So you see immigration end up being tied in, immigration rates being tied into economic indicators. The better the economy is doing, the more employment there is to offer and the fewer people in the current employment pool available to do it.
Well, and this is exactly something that I wanted to ask you and Shannon about. Here's an email from Paul in Glenn who says, why do people keep tying DACA to reducing legal immigration programs? Paul says, we have 4% unemployment and need new workers to expand our businesses and GDP. Thank you, Paul, for the email. And here in New Hampshire, the unemployment rate is even lower. And Shannon Dooling, all I hear from employers is workforce, 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 workforce. What are you hearing around New England in terms of how business leaders feel about this DACA debate?
Well, you know, I think in terms of the DACA debate in particular, business leaders, it depends on whom you ask, but you know, I will say that sort of more broadly, when you're talking about immigration policy in general and immigration trends as they are related to labor trends, there is a consistent sort of feeling among business leaders, and that is that there simply aren't enough employees to do the jobs that are available in this region. And that, you know, Massachusetts is in a bit of a unique position in that with so many institutions of higher education and so many young people that are, you know, come to this state for college and for university experiences, they, you know, are more and more staying here to explore opportunities. But in states like New Hampshire and Maine and Vermont, you know, if you talk to even refugee resettlement agencies, they are constantly being contacted by employers, by manufacturers saying, you know, do you have people in the pipeline who, you know, learning English and might be able to come in and start on the ground level in a beginning sort of position, because we need people to do these jobs. And so I don't know that personally in my reporting I've been able to really tie the DACA debate in particular to the labor needs in this region, but immigration and policy in general is something that I do hear echoed by a lot of business leaders.
Ron, what sorts of jobs are the DACA recipients that you've met? What sorts of jobs are they working?
The entire gamut. The thing about DACA is that it is essentially representative of our population as a whole, because for all intents and purposes other than the legal piece of paper which would establish that, these are American people. And they have been afforded, by and large, high-quality public educational opportunities. Sometimes financing higher education can be a huge challenge, but that's the case for most Americans these days. So we see everything from people working in service, hospitality, manufacturing, to pursuing professional tracks. We've had clients who work in banks. We have clients going to graduate school. I've read about DACA doctors around the country.
Mm-hmm. DACA and, doctors.
Correct. And eventually, you would hope that if somebody achieves enough and, you know, with enough education and enough hard work, there would be another option. In other words, maybe they could spring from DACA to some sort of professional visa that would allow them to stay without the same sort of volatility and uncertainty that DACA currently holds.
So, Shannon, a question for you. You know, we've heard about the political divide on this issue. What about business leaders, Shannon? Are they speaking out at all about DACA?
Well, the chambers of commerce have issued some support in terms of, you know, wanting to keep these DACA recipients here and figuring out a way to open up some sort of you know, ability for them to stay on the track that they're on right now. Like Ron was saying, some of them are, you know, looking at higher degrees and advanced degrees. And I think what it comes down to is, you know, looking at what is best for communities, what is best for employers, and what is best for the families. And depending on the perspective, it seems a lot of people have differing views on that.
All right. Well, coming up, we're going to dive into some of the legal issues around this. It's tangled, but we'll work our way through it. And we'll keep taking your questions and comments. So, Paul, thanks for that email. You can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477.
Everyone could do with a bit of Irish luck now and again, which is why you should support NHPR today. When you do, you'll get not one, but two chances to win a trip to Dublin, Ireland, courtesy of Milne Travel American Express. That's two chances to see the brilliant Cliffs of Moher, stroll through St. Stephen's Green, or drink in some knowledge at the Old Jameson Distillery. The lucky winner will be picked on St. Paddy's Day, but you can increase your odds now with your gift today at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, with unreliable snow and wild temperature swings, what's up with winter this year? That's tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, we're looking at the debate over DACA recipients and how that debate is playing out here in New England. Send us an email with your questions, comments, concerns. Exchange at nhpr.org. Again, exchange at nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Shannon Dooling joins us from Boston. She's a reporter for WBUR and the New England News Collaborative, where she reports on immigration in our region. Ron Abramson is here in studio, immigration attorney in Manchester. And both of you, let's go right back to our listeners. And Chris is in line. Hi, Chris. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just wondering what life would be like in New England if all the employed DACA people were to suddenly leave. There'd be a great gap.
Well, it would be about 15,000 people, Shannon Dooling, as you told us earlier. And just to paint that picture that Chris asks about, Shannon, just remind us what some of those 15,000 DACA recipients are doing.
Sure. A large number of them are students. Many of them are students and, you know, also working. They do have employment authorization with their DACA status. So, you know, maybe they're in service jobs. Maybe they are getting higher ed degrees. So they're in graduate school or they're pursuing medical degrees. It really, as Ron alluded to earlier in the hour, it really runs the gamut. We've mentioned homeowners. These are people who are starting families here. And so, you know, especially in states like Massachusetts and Connecticut, where there are larger numbers of DACA recipients, there would be a pretty big, I would say, a big pinch in some of the labor markets. And certainly, you know, we would likely lose a lot of diversity in some of our classrooms as well, in some of our universities.
Can you serve in the military and be a DACA recipient, Ron?
Yes.
And do some DACA recipients serve in the military?
Yes, and that may provide alternate avenues for obtaining residence and or eventually citizenship.
Well, we've got a couple listeners, both of you, who are just confused about the legal situation and understood. I'm a little confused myself. So let me share these with you. Mike says, I'm confused about the status of the DACA program. Was its constitutional status ever challenged in the Supreme Court? Mike says, if it was found to be constitutional by the Supreme Court and its implementation was through executive action, then what's the legal grounds for opposing its curtailment through executive action? Mike, great question. And Ron, just help us wander through this a little bit.
Sure. To date, there's been no sustained constitutional challenge to DACA. There was a subsequent program proposed by President Obama called DAPA, which was Deferred Action for Parental Accountability, which did in fact result in immediate action challenging its constitutionality. It started in the federal court in Brownsville, Texas, worked its way up through the circuit, and eventually resulted in a 4-4 decision at the U.S. Supreme Court during the period of time that there was no ninth justice. So not a clear issue by any means, but because the lower court had found it unconstitutional, the Supreme Court's decision did not disturb that. In terms of DACA, the challenges have been that it was essentially revoked without due process, without following certain regulations, and that was spearheaded first by a case brought in California, which has by far the most number of Dreamers or DACA recipients at around 200,000, and then another case in New York. And a week ago today, I believe, the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear essentially a direct appeal of the California decision, so that case will need to work its way up through the courts, and it could be months, many months, before there's a U.S. Supreme Court decision on that.
So a direct appeal means, you know, I go straight to the U.S. Supreme Court with my issue. Normally cases, you know, make their way through all these lower courts and appeals courts and so forth.
Correct. And it would be an extremely unusual legal step.
So here's Mike's question. He says, if it was found to be constitutional by the Supreme Court and its implementation was through executive action, then what's the legal grounds for opposing its curtailment through executive action? It's sort of like, you know, if you do one by executive action, can't you curtail it by executive action?
That's a fair question. In other words, if the president had the authority to issue it, why wouldn't the next president have the authority to revoke it?
Which shows the problem with doing things through executive action.
That's absolutely correct. And just because there is a power to do something doesn't mean that there aren't applicable regulations, procedures, and in some cases vested due process rights as to how it is done. And essentially right now, there are no new DACA applications being accepted, but anybody who had DACA previously may currently file to renew, and that effectively obliterates today, March 5th, as the drop-dead deadline for somebody who would have otherwise not been able to apply until tomorrow or beyond.
So no new applications, Ron, that's changed. But if you have DACA status right now, you can apply today for another 2-year?
Correct, based on the injunctions issued by California and New York.
Shannon, I can hear you want to jump in on the legal questions too.
Yeah, thanks. So a couple things, I think, just to sort of echo what Ron was explaining there. It's interesting to see that many of the New England states actually signed on to that New York court case. And so there is sort of this, I would say, you know, Democratic attorney generals in some of the states signed on. Basically, what's at question here, as Ron was saying, and this is just another way to say the same thing, I guess, but is that it, you know, the challenge isn't whether or not President Trump has the authority to dismantle DACA. It's the manner in which he went about doing it and the animus or the motivation behind doing it that is a question in the lower courts right now. And so to your commenter's point, that's basically what the difference is, right? It's a procedural thing, as Ron alluded to, and you know, I think we talked a little bit about the renewal process there, and you know, it's a $500 a pop application price, so you know, you're coming up with this money, and there's no guarantee that. You know, there's no guarantee that the program will last any longer, you know, beyond the court decisions, really. I mean, it has to work its way through the lower courts at this point. You come up with this $500 every 2 years. You, as we've mentioned, you know, offer up your updated information to a government that has made it pretty clear under President Trump, does not necessarily... has new enforcement priorities than the previous administration. And so there's always that question of what happens to my information once I enroll for renewal of this program.
That's what we talked about earlier, Shannon, right? You know, that it was, you get some benefits if you apply for DACA, but there's some real risks involved in sort of saying,
that's right.
You know, raising your hand.
Yeah. And there's one young woman who I keep thinking about, and I met her a couple of days before the DACA. You know, we thought that this decision from the administration might come down back in September. And I visited with her on her first day of class. She was a freshman at UMass Boston. And her first day of classes happened to be the same day that Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced the end of this program that got her to college. And she was born in El Salvador. She came to the U.S. As a very young child. She has two sisters, both of whom are also in the country with DACA. They all have different renewal dates, so they have different eligibilities in terms of when to, you know, when they can renew for their status. And, you know, she was just explaining to me on this first day of college, she's looking on her phone and looking for the news back in September and saw the news. And she said, I'm just going to try to keep focused and stay present here and try to take advantage of this while I can, because I don't know how long this will last.
Yeah, I remember reading that piece that you did, Shannon. And speaking of college students, we have an email from Kevin who says, how do undocumented immigrants get student loans? I thought you needed a Social Security number for a government-backed loan. And I was surprised too, Ron, that either you or Shannon said that you could go to college, get a student loan. So it's this weird status of DACA recipients.
Well, there's a coinage that some people use, which is that these folks are documented, which puts them sort of in a hybrid status of sorts. But there may not be eligibility for all federal student loan programs, but a person who has DACA status is here temporarily with lawful permission. So
they're here sort of legally, even though that status of being legal is temporary.
Correct. And it has you mentioned this earlier, it has to do with, is it a substantive status? Is it leading to another more permanent, directly a solution? Not necessarily. But as far as a person who is pursuing higher education is concerned, if they have a social security number, they have a document that shows they are here with permission through a certain date, up to 2 years into the future, then they can pursue higher education. They may be eligible for some grants. Certainly any private donations that are privately administrated may be fair game. Gets a little more complicated in public institutions of higher learning. But yes, they are here with lawful permission, and that's where the discussion starts to break down sometimes, because there's this conflation of all of this as one big group of, quote, illegals. And DACA specifically is not that.
Come out of the shadows and be legal.
Right. Be out in the open, and we'll give you our word that we're not going to deport you for a period of time and legal permission to work and or go to school.
Interesting. So, all right. So whether you call them legal or illegal is kind of a matter of choice, Ron. Sounds like they're legal temporarily.
Right. And those terms get loaded and have more technical meaning. So I just try to come back around to say they have permission to be here.
Here's another email from Steve, who says, as I understand, DACA people / illegal immigrants will be counted for the census. This will result in some states gaining U.S. reps in the Congress. Please discuss. Steve, thank you for the email. And the census is a big deal, and this does come up. Either of you know, Shannon, are DACA recipients counted in the census?
I cannot say for certain. My guess, my sort of educated guess would be that that they can be. I mean, the thing about the census, right, is that it's whoever answers the census, right? So, you know, if someone who's, as Ron alluded to, documented, they might have a little more comfort and a little more confidence in their protection, so to speak. They're you know, free from deportation for 2 years, the threat of deportation for at least the 2 years that their status is eligible or valid. But, you know, I think consistently what is a challenge in terms of quantifying the number of people in the country without documentation and who have come here illegally is getting those folks in those households to, you know, to stand up and be counted for at fear of sort of being outed, if you will, and becoming more vulnerable to deportation.
So I can see why, Ron, that DACA recipients might be counted in the census, because they are, as you and Shannon have said, documented, and I had not heard that until today. But illegal immigrants, people who are not covered by DACA status, are they counted for the census?
The census is supposed to be a nonpartisan information gathering endeavor. So as I understand it, it's supposed to count all of the people who live in this country. How that data gets further broken down, analyzed, utilized, that's a different, much more loaded question. But yes, and that is exactly right. As Shannon just said, it is inherently contradictory and challenging to count people who, by definition, are trying not to be visible.
You know, we keep touching on sort of the legal status of this group, but also we keep coming back to the political status of this group. And we've heard some concerns from our listeners today. Shannon, I wonder how you would gauge the politics around DACA here in New England, recognizing that this tends to be politically a more liberal region of the country.
Yeah, well, you know, in terms of action taken by political leaders, I mentioned a little while ago that the Democratic attorney generals in it was Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Vermont, and Maine all, you know, signed on to lawsuits arguing that the administration's decision to end DACA was arbitrary. And as far as sort of, you know, at the governorship level, even in Massachusetts here, our Republican Governor Charlie Baker has come out in support of DACA recipients, really advocating for some sort of solution, long-term solution to keep these young people here. You know, I think, again, as Ron mentioned, we have seen in poll after poll after poll that, you know, nationwide, not just here in New England, where, you know, we do sort of live at times in this liberal-leaning bubble, but nationwide, there have been polls that really have people have been able, for whatever reason, to differentiate when it comes to these DACA recipients with sort of the another image of an illegal immigrant that they might conjure up. You know, the DACA recipients were brought here as very young children by their parents most of the time, or they met their parents here, and so there is more, it seems, more empathy, I think, for people of that status, but tying that to broader immigration reform clearly seems to be the sort of stumbling block in many cases.
So that's where New England differs politically from the rest of the country, or parts of the country, Shannon. Is that what you're saying?
I think so. I think so. You know, and I think by and large, when we're looking at the way our political leaders have responded to the administration's decision, there has been support. I mean, Governor Gina Raimondo in Rhode Island set up a legal fund to help pay for renewal fees. We mentioned it's $500 an application every 2 years to renew that DACA application. And the state raised almost $200,000, you know, at the behest of the governor to support DACA recipients. And so, you know, there is a sense of trying to get behind them. And I think in New England, there is a bit of more motivation to sort of look at immigration as a whole than maybe we are seeing throughout the rest of the country.
Well, and we've talked a lot to Ron throughout the hour about how Congress and the president keep kicking the can down the road. What do you think is going to happen next? I mean, today was supposed to be the day, and here we are. It's not the day.
I think, as with so many important issues in the last year in particular, the courts are going to have a huge role in deciding exactly how we're going to be able to move forward, especially when it comes to taking away something that was previously granted. But there are a lot of people in Congress who claim to have good faith in terms of their willingness to fix this. But so far, we haven't seen that play out with a majority support.
All right. Well, Ron, thank you very much for helping us out. We appreciate
it. My pleasure.
Ron Abramson, immigration attorney based in Manchester. Shannon Dooling, it was great to have you, too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Shannon Dooling, reporter for BUR and the New England News Collaborative, where she reports on immigration. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.